Hello, and welcome to More Podcast, Less Process, the Archives Podcast, produced jointly between Metro and AV Preserve. And this is Josh, and I'm here with...
This is Jefferson.
Oh, hi, Jefferson.
Hey, Josh, how's it going?
Oh, not bad. How are you doing?
Good.
Good.
January, it's cold.
Yeah, weekend. Ready for the big game? Oh, we can't say... bleep that out. We can't say... We're going to get sued by the NFL. It's the weekend of the big game.
They've closed a lot of Broadway, from what I hear.
They have, yes.
Yeah. There's a marching band outside earlier.
I've closed down a lot of Broadway. Back in my salad days.
I'm sorry, I have to go.
So, welcome to the podcast. We're here. Today's topic is video. Which is really strange for an audio podcast, I know. But we're going to talk about video, and we have three guests here. I'll let them introduce themselves.
My name's Eric Peel. I'm an archivist at Anthology Film Archives.
Oh, wait. The topic is video.
Anthology Video Archive, right?
This is me walking out right now. well, I'm actually... I'm an archivist at Anthology, but I'm also a video tech and a manager at DoArt. Film and video in Midtown Manhattan.
Hey, I'm Peter Luxick. I'm an assistant media conservator at the Museum of Modern Art, and I'm also adjunct faculty in the Moving Image Archiving and Preservation Program at NYU, teaching video preservation.
I'm Nicole Martin. I'm the multimedia archivist and systems manager at Human Rights Watch, and that is my only job.
Okay, so that sounds like the most interesting, so we'll probably start there. So, Nicole... That's a big complicated title. What exactly does that entail and how does that fit in? Like, what is Human Rights Watch and how does your job fit in with what they do?
Okay. Human Rights Watch is an international organization that was founded in 1978, and we do human rights work all over the world, and sort of the heart of our organization is a series of reports that comes out annually, sometimes between like 100 and 150 reports that are written by around 100 researchers. And I always hesitate to quote numbers because we are growing really quickly. So I don't know if that's quite accurate. But in addition to these text reports that have like an introduction describing like a human rights situation, set of violations, and recommendations for how those violations should be dealt with by a particular government or group, we also have... we create a great deal of multimedia to go along with those text reports. So like video, audio, slideshows, the works. And I archive and just basically keep track of all that stuff. Human Rights Watch has never had an archivist in this position before. And we didn't necessarily have like an IT infrastructure to accommodate all of this material. So in addition to archiving the stuff, I also sort of help to build the infrastructure, hence the systems manager portion of my title.
So what you do, you have to verge a lot more like into the IT world as well and work in those areas also.
It's true. Yeah. I'm not entirely alone, but any help I can get is always greatly appreciated.
So. Yeah, well, it's probably worth going around and everybody, beyond just their names and titles, talking, I guess, more what they do day-to-day within their institutions? Is that a good place to start? Is that worthwhile?
Sure.
We made four Josh. But.
No, it's a good idea. I mean, we've got a big group here, and it's a lot of varied stuff, and I thought it would be interesting to talk about video from this point of view of these different, very different organizations that do work with very different types of materials and handle it a very different ways because of that, none of which are wrong. They're not necessarily right, but they're not necessarily wrong. But
Josh will tell us later which is right.
To talk about this idea, you know, that video exists, it exists, video collections exist in lots of different places, and what you do with it kind of depends on what your organization is and what the work is as well. So, I think that'd be good. So Peter, what do you, at MoMA, you know, what kind of materials are you working with? What do you do there?
With, I guess, time-based media conservation, I deal with artworks that are within our collection that involve time. So that's video, audio, film, slide-based work. So I guess along the video, I guess as my role as a conservator, we advise on acquisition. So when works are coming into the collection, we make sure that we get the work in a way that can be actively preserved for the future. So the dialogue begins there with the artist and the curator, and then do general collection care, and then making exhibition media and the installation guides for both exhibitions within the museum as well as outgoing loans. So I guess along the lines of video, when I started at MoMA, there was an initiative to migrate the entire single channel video works to digital carriers, essentially. And what we discovered was that, and this is yet to be confirmed, but I believe MoMA has one of the largest single channel video collections of a fine arts collecting institution. We have about 1,600 pieces in the collection, thanks largely to Barbara London, who started the collection in the mid to late 70s. So I kind of managed the migration of that to make it available within the museum in an exhibition known as the Media Lounge, where all of that work, you could go and see and queue up and look at stuff. So that's kind of what I do broadly.
What's single channel video?
Single channel video is, I guess, a conservation term to differentiate it from multi-channel video, where, yeah, it's just a single piece. And it'll be shown on one screen or one monitor, depending on what the work is and what the artist's intent is. But we tend to separate that from larger installation-based artwork.
So, like, the big game would be multi-channel.
I don't know what the big game is.
The big game this weekend.
It would be... Yeah. Yeah, sure. Yeah, multi-channel.
Okay, cool.
So, Eric, so you're... at Anthology, which is also deals with art and, you know, art works in a way, but it's a slightly different focus than MoMA. So what do you work on?
Well, for people who don't know Anthology was started in 1970 as this exhibition space for presenting avant-garde film and film as art. But since its opening, Anthology did have a very aggressive video series starting in around 1974 with Shigeko Kubota as the first video curator. So we do have a lot of video installations and performances that happen in Anthology that we've documented. But the main goal of Anthology is film preservation, as it states in the name. And we do have two Selznick-educated film conservators, archivists on our team that do a great job of photochemically preserving film works. So my job in Anthology is kind of, I'm the first digital archivist there. I'm, you know, bring it back to one of the earlier podcasts, kind of like a change agent within the institution to kind of offer a level of alterity when it comes to showing works, as every institution needs right now. So I assist in the creation of digital exhibition copies of films. Also, on the exhibition side, I'm heavily involved in the theaters and showing films in Anthology. And also preserving, like I said, the video documentation that we have. And then also my other job, which I spend a lot of time at DuArt, is working with institutions for reformatting their collections. And that deals with a lot of very early analog video dating, you know, from 2-inch quad up until, you know, high definition formats and even like tapeless workflows. So I'm kind of involved in like a lot of different things. A lot of fast-moving objects.
What's a tapeless workflow exactly? Or for the generalist?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of broadcast productions happening right now, in which they find it easier to not shoot off of tape and just move strictly with born digital content. So with that workflow comes a whole new set of questions and operations on how to successfully move stuff over for broadcast distribution as well as archiving, as everybody knows in this room.
So it kind of came up you all have newly created positions, or they were new positions when you entered them, and I think this is probably common in the field of audiovisual and digital preservation. We've talked about here before, as Eric pointed out, but also is kind of popping up a lot now. Discussions that are going on generally in archiving about people, you know, talking about making your own position or that kind of stuff. So what has that experience been like? It's a, of being, you know, you're placed somewhere, you have no, you're the expert once you get in there, basically.
Hypothetically.
Yeah.
Well, it's actually interesting because all of us, I should also reveal, are graduates of the MIAC program. So, I remember when I was a student worker with Nicole, and we were talking about this exact thing as students, and I still remember something you said where it's like you make your job just by doing your job. So you kind of go in and do the work, and then you're like, see how valuable this is? And I think we're all kind of proof of that's how you get in there, and that's how you kind of prove the worth of this work is by just doing it for them, because you can't explain it very well. Or people just won't understand it unless you kind of give them the product. Yeah, I don't know if you want to talk about
that. Yeah, I think that's very true, and it's cool that you remember it. And it's interesting going into an institution also, like Human Rights Watch, I think, started accumulating so much data and had no idea what to do with all of it, but spent a great deal of money producing it and wanted to retain it, which I think is just really common. Obviously, like, that's why we have these jobs. But it's also funny to start in those positions because a lot of internal advocacy is necessary, not only for your position, but for the work to continue and for it to continue at a scale that can keep up with like production or acquisition or whatever it might be. And I also find that the tools to do our jobs aren't widely available. And if they are, they're incredibly expensive. And sometimes the products that you end up with, like digital asset management systems or other systems, are we pay a lot of money for something that's maybe not terribly customizable or a great fit for whatever kind of archiving that we're doing. So, I mean, I love this work, and I love walking in and trying to build something from scratch. It's just like really fun and like thrilling. But I also think, you know, time will make it a little easier on us.
Hopefully.
For now, we like only have each other to bounce ideas off of.
That's true.
Well, there's actually a sort of a follow-up question to that is that, you know, obviously everyone is reporting to managers and stakeholders that don't necessarily have a great, you know, real idea, not idea of what you're doing, but at least like knowledge of your processes. And so there's sort of the potential for false expectations from above. So it'd be interesting to hear whether those are challenges that you've encountered and how to deal with them. And of course, I'm not talking about your current managers. Only past ones are speaking very generally.
I guess in my experience, I want to say, like, I'm not knocking any of our institutions. I mean, like, that they recognize the need for this by seeing the work that we're doing and then, you know, made the commitment to make these positions and hire us and our fellow colleagues. But yeah, in my experience with like managers who aren't as well versed, they just trust in what myself and my colleagues have to say and just put a lot of faith into us and recognize, or hopefully recognize, that we're doing the job to the best of our ability. So I haven't really experienced it that much. But there is a lot of just like, this actually got brought up recently where me and my colleagues in media conservation, other conservators were like, well, what do you guys actually do? We just see you on a computer all the time. We're like, no, we're really doing stuff. I swear, we're really doing stuff.
Yeah, I'd agree with that too. I actually get great support from my direct supervisor. What's up, Pierre? And but I do think that organization-wide, I think it can be difficult for people to understand kind of what it is that everyone, I mean, like our institution has like 300 plus employees, so I don't really know what everyone does anyway. And sort of finding even someone's actual job that they do as opposed to their job description or their title can be complicated. But in a new position, that's a pretty seemingly a very niche position. There can be like a lot of questions and explanations that have to go along with that. Like even my parents, when I decided to go to NYU's Moving Image Archiving and Preservation program, were like, we don't think it's for you. but it turned out to be a good a good choice, and as time goes on again, it's becoming a little easier for folks to understand. Even just with, you know, all the digital technology that we consume constantly, I just feel like this field is going to be enormous.
Yeah, and also, like, I think we all have a pretty nerdy enthusiasm for this, and a lot of it is solved just by institutional advocacy and education. It's just like people may not know, but we just sit down and explain it to them, and I can say in probably all of our fields, IT is now an essential ally in doing our work, and in my experience, it's just been like sitting down and explaining it to them, and they've been totally on board, and just like, how can we help you, and great allies, at least at MoMA.
Yeah, Eric seems to have had, I wanted to ping you about, but about how you have this kind of IT technical info crossover happening where a lot of folks from DuArt were leaving at the same time that you need a new kind of like technical support.
Yeah, I think that between, but just going back to what you were just saying, I think we have a lot of the idiosyncrasies of the field covered, spread out evenly throughout a lot of people. And, you know, I think I do my job well at Anthology because I'm very much informed about a lot of the high-speed stakes happening at DuArt, which, you know, for people that don't know, DuArt was a film processing lab dating back to the 20s, and now they've kind of moved towards a lot of digital production of assets, and we host a lot of different production companies in our building. So in the 3 years that I've worked there, we've kind of saw a sea change, and I work very closely with an engineer there, and he's kind of had to, you know, redesign the architecture multiple times, and I've kind of been there when he's been doing this, so I've kind of picked up a lot, and you know, I don't think anybody in the field can know everything about the field, but, you know, like I said, I think when you have this network of people that are concentrating on the idiosyncrasies of, you know, preservation of the moving image and recorded sound, then you're pretty good.
Eric, I was wondering, in your position at Anthology, like how defined that was, because Anthology was, you know, they had an archive there and had people in the position of taking care of stuff, people who were trained at the Celestine School in Rochester, you know, at least from the film point of view, and had interns doing stuff. So it was more, you know, probably more of a tradition, you know, that there was some kind of traditional archive there that was focused on media. But, you know, how did the role that digital plays in that now, how did that fit in? Was it well-defined? Did you have to work to define it more?
There was the beginning of an IT portion of Anthology that was started by a former MIAP graduate and a good colleague. And
whose name is
John Passmore, who's now at WNYC. Hey, John. So when I came in, I felt like that was pretty well established. But I started contributing more in terms of like reformatting and starting to think about in-house analog to digital workflows that Anthology needed. And there has been an increase in our IT architecture, our digital storage architecture, since I've been there. But I think mostly the concentration is on, you know, reformatting multiple different kinds of formats, you know, encompassing film and audio and video. I'm very thankful for John to come in and to do what he had done. Mm-hmm.
One thing you mentioned is storage, and you know, maybe this is like a big generalist question, but you know, I think at least a lot of comments you hear from archivists that don't necessarily have familiarity with video really well is like the issue of storage, right? I mean, video is very easy to create. A lot of academic and institutional archives are getting a lot of video, and obviously, like a big challenge is storage. So. Let's talk about storage. I don't really know. It's not really a question, but
yeah. How many petabytes are you
at? Yeah.
We're not there yet. Operative word being yet.
Two words, Blu-ray disc.
No, man, dots. Yeah, no, storage.
Has it been a challenge? Yes. I mean, or is it like, obviously, like the investment of IT and the collaborating with them helps with this a lot, but it must be something that is just, you know, growing exponentially.
Yeah, I mean, it is a challenge. We are actually currently in development on a digital repository for museum collections, the DRMC, which will essentially be our digital storage for artworks that we are collecting. So akin to right now, all the artwork is stored at MoMA Queens. So it'll be kind of essentially the same thing, but in a digital environment. And my colleague Ben Fino-Radden's largely developing that right now.
With some help from AV Preserve.
Sorry. With huge help from AV Preserve. Yeah, Kara Van Malsen was there from the very beginning in 2008 for planning for this. But I guess key to that was getting IT's involvement very early on, getting them on board. And now we're just trying to stay out ahead of the curve because at MoMA we have a film department that has been around since the 1930s. And we think in the next year or two, they will start collecting solely born digital films. So we are kind of basing our storage projections on this kind of huge influx of material. At least at my institution, everyone has been very supportive and kind of understands the need for this.
Everywhere I've had two jobs as like a digital archivist, basically. And in my former position at Democracy Now!, which is like a live daily TV show, we had several servers, each like a maybe I think like 8 or 10 terabytes each. And at my current position, we have one very large server. But in addition to storage being a challenge in terms of just space, in a production environment, speed is a big issue. Lots of clients accessing the storage at the same time. And just general traffic issues are huge. Even for archives that are not enormous, a storage without a lot of bandwidth can be a big, issue in terms of access. And in addition to that, I think because the field is new, in some cases, storage itself is actually not optimized for good performance for the environment that you're working in, whether it's like a Mac environment or a Windows environment. And the way that that storage is set up is often a big hindrance to the work that we do. So space, speed, having people on staff who have a good handle on how all this stuff works together can be, it's just like an essential part of day-to-day stuff.
I think it's definitely about, heavily researching alternate methods and going simultaneously to like two or three different routes, hard disk storage, LTO storage, tape storage. Obviously, you have scalability issues. I feel like I'm not at that point with Anthology where we're hitting, where it's not, where everything is still scalable. So, you can still ramp up hard disk space and, you can still lay off to tape. And it's not going to be the situation in which you have 30,000 LTOs that you have to migrate because you're, two generations down already. God help us if that happens.
So there was a good, Peter, you talked about the repository, mm-hmm. and I think this is a good kind of distinction to make. I mean, that the MoMA repository is, in a way, it's like the vault for the artist.
Yes.
It's not just storage. That it's not just like a hard drive kind of thing or something. It's performing a certain aspect of.
Yeah, it's an entire infrastructure. Yeah, it's not just spinning discs. There's a lot of moving parts to it to make sure. Because we're purchasing these artworks that are in our collections, we have to treat them as such. But sorry, I cut you off.
Yeah, no, it's used to it. But I think in general, that's kind of the difference. When we talk about audiovisual preservation, that you have these different pieces to it, where you may have something that's something preserved that's offline, protected like that, but then you have the piece, you have the piece that that people are accessing every day to produce something with, kind of thing, or you have the piece that's being streamed online, which is a different thing, which is a different story. Could be a different storage solution too. So even you may have different solutions for it, but you may have different tiers of that for depending on what you're actually working with there too. So
yeah, it's a good segue to the sort of access question, which you talked about a little bit. And I know the DRMC has a lot of emulation pieces and delivery within MoMA to curators. Mm-hmm. So it would be interesting just to hear from everyone about like the access question. I'm just asking really broad questions without, but I think that's a good one. It comes out of storage naturally. Obviously, I mean, you can have dark storage, but you also like can have, you know, access copies and stuff like that. And, you know, video poses challenges to both of those that, you know, even born digital like manuscript material doesn't necessarily pose. So
yeah, at Human Rights Watch there are many different levels of access. There's the level of like public access, which is like our final distributed works that are distributed to like news outlets internationally, governments, all kinds of different people, funders. And then there's also a level of internal organizational access that comes through our digital asset management system. And there is a server that hosts all the proxy, like all the preview files for everything that's ever passed through the digital asset management system. There's also a tier of access for just the production staff, like the multimedia staff itself. And that is like the really quick performing server, like super fast storage. And then beyond that, there's also a level of offline storage, so LTO storage. That's also kind of supplemented by external hard drives. So there's like for every piece of data that we can't fit on our production server that the production team has access to, there's like one LTO tape, well, two LTO tapes and one external hard drive. So that media can be like basically mounted as a server volume at any time for anyone in the production staff. So they have like fast access to the entire collection. And again, the preview files are accessible to them in the digital asset management system. So there are all kinds of like little rules and policies put in there, like levels of security, especially for Human Rights Watch, because the kind of work that we do. And then I guess the security question is like a whole different challenge, but and applies differently to different organizations. Yeah, a lot of access and security are like intrinsically, you know, tied.
And is that serving up different formats to people depending on demand, or how does that work?
Yep, totally different formats. And each level of access has its own format. And then the production team, of course, has like kind of a little mixed bag of formats that they use.
Yeah, well, I guess at the museum, we also have a digital asset management system. And all of this is still kind of in the works right now. This is in production, so it's kind of theoretical at this point. But the idea is, you know, like Josh said, the digital repository is going to be kind of our vault for the artwork. And that'll be very controlled access to really just media conservation. And then providing kind of preview access, I think, through our DAM of material so curators can get a sense of it, because right now they can't actually watch the pieces very easily, which is incredibly important if they're curating a show to get a sense of, you know, what it actually is. So that'll be like a streaming option or something like that. But yeah, obviously we have very tight control of access. And then for exhibition, because we're exhibiting purely born digital now, file-based, that'll still be a manual method where we'll actually create the exhibition files primarily through media conservation. So very small points of access to our system.
Yeah, I think I'm very much similar to you guys in that, you know, we have areas of deep storage, different tiers for like serving up derivative access copies. We're an institution that just, you know, if a researcher sends a request, we can set them up with a digital screening of a work. As far as online access, we do have a collections website that's going to be rolling out in the next few months or so. And part of my job is to make derivatives for that site based on bandwidth limitations and things like that. And it's certainly very interesting. I know you guys haven't really brought it up, but, you know, especially with early analog video, there's a series of processes that you have to do to the image in order to display, in order to show it on a modern display device. You know, we can list them if we want, you know, such as deinterlacing and things like that. So I'm heavily invested in those kinds of processes. And, you know, as far as exhibition is concerned, you know, that people should be aware of like things like frame rates and carrying this kind of metadata across all tiers of, you know, access and preservation and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So Eric and Peter, I know you work, you've been transferring stuff, digitizing materials.
Yes.
Nicole, do you work with any legacy materials at Human Rights Watch? Are you...
Not a lot. Partly because a large migration effort was undertaken before my time, which is also part of the need to have an archivist on board. But a couple of hundred master tapes were digitized before I started offsite at a migration facility. So we have all of that content, and that...
What format?
DV25.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. Okay. So something small, NSD.
But not easy.
No. I guess, well, it depends sometimes. Yeah, so we do have all that content digitized to like a small, not a large format. And we also, around the time of that migration process, we started producing our own content. And before that time, we mostly relied on like external contractors and stuff, to production companies, to make our content. So we would sort of hire shooters and videographers in the field to make video and have it edited and put together by a production company. So we don't have all of the outtakes from that period, but we do have a decent amount of like mini DV tape from that time and DV cam, and we were able to migrate all of that and digitize it. But any non-digital tape format, we don't actually have the equipment, because we never had a production facility for that content.
And so what do you mean by digital tape format?
Like mini DV tape, DV cam, HDV. That's about it.
Okay.
We don't do like Digibeta or anything too fancy. We were kind of had sort of like the prosumer setup from probably like 2000 to 2008. And now all of our content is born digital, so it comes on SD cards. And that stuff just, you know, doesn't change at all. Play it where it lays.
So, well, yeah, but I know you all have experience with, you know, with transferring video and setting up stations for transferring video and other work, audio too. I just thought maybe we could talk about that a little bit. Just, I'm not sure what to talk about there. But I think it would be an interesting thing, because I think there's, you know, we've worked with several places that to install labs, and I know some of you have too, to, you know, help them in like a university or something install their own kind of lab so they can do some digitization in-house, their own transfers, and kind of manage that process themselves. And so it's a, you know, for some of our listeners, that might be an interesting kind of thing to know that it's possible. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's cheaper, mm-hmm, than outsourcing. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, what's your experience with that kind of thing? Like, just what is it like working with transferring video? You know, do you need some super complex setup, or do you just need a record player that hooks into your laptop? Or
well, I mean, like you said, like it depends on what your mission is, or what your goal is in digitizing the analog material. So, like, if it's just purely for access and it's just to get the content off and available, then I would say a DIY setup is totally feasible, and it's not very difficult to manage. And actually, the nice thing about obsolescence in one way is things are really cheap right now, because everybody thinks that there's no need for them. And I know Eric has experience getting dirt cheap gear. Different projects necessitate different setups, I would say. So at MoMA, we kind of have like a very large, kind of granular setup, set to like really dive deep into files and analog material to see what's going on for comparisons and stuff like that. But yeah, for like the transfer station, which happened at the new museum over the past summer, it was a pretty... I think Eric and I both donated equipment for that. And that was really just to get the material off. Want to add anything?
Yeah, I think even before reformatting, institutions who are interested in this kind of work should definitely work to get, you know, playback stations. And, you know, just so you can even view things that you're getting back from vendors properly. Because I think that that's definitely a recurring problem in which, you know, you can do a transfer and then submit it to a client, and the client's like looking at it, you know, on a laptop or something like that. And, you know, it's an early analog video, and, you know, the color spaces don't necessarily match. So there's this level of miscommunication. So I guess the first step would be to kind of build a system in which you can properly view, you know, stuff that you get back from vendors and things like that. But like, you know, what Peter said, we do live in a time where like we're on the tail end of the broadcast industry. So you try, an archive should definitely try to take advantage of that in getting to know different kinds of like production houses and like what they're getting ready to like phase out. I have like a very big list of production companies and vendors and people like that. And I'm kind of like always on the watch for different kinds of decks and things that I need for my transfer station. But, you know, the opportunity cost of that is that it's definitely, it takes a lot of your time to do a lot of like systems engineering. And a lot of the times I feel that there are some instances in which I could just be like, well, this is definitely easier if I sent it out to a vendor and possibly more cost effective. Not most of the time, but I feel like, you know, if you want to do something like that within an institution, you have to commit a person to doing that. You know, it can't just be someone who's, you know, there, but their goal is to catalog the collection or something like that. You have to have a technician within the institution.
Mm-hmm. I mean, but that being said, I feel like a lot of people are very daunted by it, where they think of this as kind of a dark art that, you know, is impossible to learn, very difficult to learn, which isn't the case. You know, all of us are relatively new to this very new field, and we all picked it up, and I'm teaching people every year, and I feel like that's kind of the common refrain of like, oh, this, I don't know, understand how this is working, and then there's just a very minor learning curve, and then it's just the experience of doing it is where you gain all the knowledge. But I would say it's not very difficult and not as daunting as people think it is.
Yeah, I think it depends largely on, again, like what Peter was saying, the needs of your institution or company, and the types of formats that you have in house. Like at Democracy Now, we had DAT tapes, audio cassette, mini DV, DV cam, HDV, like decks running, oh, and quarter inch audio, like running all the time, because that equipment was all pretty accessible, except for DAT, which is like really weird. But we also had a huge stack of mini discs that we couldn't ever quite figure out what to do with. There are a couple of different ways to play mini disc back. One was kind of the best, and we couldn't get it running for a couple of different reasons. So these like kind of some of the quirkier formats out there, like Video 8, Hi8, that stuff is like really threatened now because there are very few decks. It wasn't a terribly popular format, but there's some great content there that needs to be saved. And then analog video is, I think, a little more complicated than the formats that we were doing that I mentioned. And you need, I think, a little more, probably a little more research. It's like to be like a DIY setup is possible, but it has to be your baby, you know?
Yeah, it's a commitment.
Yeah.
And I should also say, like, by format, too, there are formats that are very robust and very stable. Like, I feel like, you know, U-matic, while there is, like, binder hydrolysis issues and stuff like that, it's a fairly kind of sturdy format, while Hi8 was primarily consumer and fairly chintzy format where, you know, I've had experiences where the camera recording the tape was misaligned, so you can never, you have to break a deck to misalign it to get the proper alignment. So kind of as formats progressed, they got worse and need a bit more attention. That's when you would call kind of a vendor, like DuArt.
That's like the black art side of it.
Yeah, that's the dark art, yeah.
The deck breaking digitization.
And DATs, oh, they are the worst.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's sort of a dark art, but it's sort of not, I mean, you know, it's just to, for some of our listeners, just to describe alignment is basically like where the tape lines up with the record or the playback head that it's running across. Mm-hmm. You know, if you think about, well, some people may not even know a cassette deck. Audio cassette deck. That's probably like the really like
you
basic.
Are our listeners. I don't know.
Like senior sit stop sounds... listening now.
I don't know. I've heard stories of people who could not work a VHS player. So of students, you know, kind of coming in not knowing like what is this thing. Anyway, sorry, but that's good. I mean, if you think about that, that's kind of like that's a big head where you can really like see. Obviously, the tape is running over that. It has to be lined up in the right way with it. And mm-hmm. so, yeah, with the some of those later small formats, it's, yeah.
It's problematic, yeah.
And then long before digitization even happens, too, to just kind of, I think it's good to touch on monitoring and, like, kind of checking out, doing mm-hmm. a collection assessment, seeing what shape your collection is in, which is something that Josh Ranger here taught me to do.
Yeah, I think we all
taught me how to
learn from Josh.
How to spot that dirty socks odor coming from a tape.
Josh knows his dirty socks.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah, it's an unmistakable smell.
He's like
smell.
A sommelier of fine hydrolysis.
It snowed last night. My socks got
So yeah, if you have an audio collection, a quarter inch or audio cassette collection, and you're not familiar with that dirty socks odor, it'll come out for you. You'll never forget it. Yeah. But yeah, just taking a look and seeing what kind of shape your collection is in can be like sort of half the battle.
That's very, yeah, that's actually a really good point, is that like that's always should be the first step of just like a general, you know, whether it's a collection assessment or an item level collection assessment, and that'll really help figure things out for you in the migration process tremendously rather than just, you know, bulldozing right in.
Yes, and I head up assessments and inventories with AV Preserve. So you'd like to contact me?
when doing assessments like this, you know, once after the information has been gathered and you're working with analog legacy material, what's sort of the prioritization as far as what you want to treat first or take care or digitize first or send out first? I'm sure there are many factors, but what would be some good ones besides obvious deterioration?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's like the video specific ones are just like deterioration and then, you know, obsolescence. So 2-inch, for example, it's very hard to find a 2-inch quad transfer stations. You would prioritize those. It's kind of you're looking at what's the most obsolete and tackling those first. But then the other side of it is the content. So it's like based on your institution, what is the most important to get access to first? So it's kind of you're weighing both at the same time.
Yeah, you have to have a good sense of, you know, when you're prioritizing, like, what are the available playback formats that vendors even have? You know, it's good to have that list in your head every year of, you know, who has, you know, this type of deck and, you know, this is getting phased out. So I think it's on the back of everyone's mind or in the front.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. Keeping a list of those vendors who have those formats is something that does need to be updated like constantly. Like that's so true. And also their pricing changes because one vendor will drop out and then three more will. And the only transfer station left, you know, will charge like an arm and a leg for a certain format. So cost and obsolescence are a big... Mm-hmm. I mean, it is really incredible. Like I think... I've only been working in the field for like, you know, a number of years. And in that time, the list of formats has just really dwindled like for what's available. It's astounding how quickly I think things happen. Like we all knew that certain formats were going to be inaccessible and obsolete soon, but it's impossible to project. It's really fast.
And also going along with it, I've been amazed just by the changes in kind of best practices and preservation have been changing as well. Because I want to say, like, when we both started in this field, the recommended best practice has completely changed. So not to say that, like, those efforts were futile in 2008, 2009, but you also have to stay very actively vested in that and keeping track of, like, oh, what is the digital preservation format now? Like, what are we capable of now? While also, yeah, kind of looking at your formats and stuff like that.
what is the preferred preservation format?
Yes, tell us, what is the best format? I get this question.
We're
going to
put it on the internet. If you say it, we're going to put it on the internet. We're going to tweet it.
We have the specialist here.
There's going to be a
There's going to be a run on uncompressed files.
I'll run. Yeah.
Yeah. We're going to run out of them. Yeah.
There's only a finite amount of like bitcoins.
let's short the Blu-ray stack right now.
I don't know. I think that'd be a good question for Eric since he's kind of been on the vendor side of things.
Well, I think it is one that's like relative to an institution. I don't think there's the perfect preservation file format, but I think there are perfect preservation formats, you know? And there's institutions that are dealing with, you know, MXF wrapped files, or there are institutions dealing with uncompressed files. And they're all kind of skewed towards that institution's policies. And I should also mention too that there is a movement to get more open file formats out there, which I think one in particular, FFV1, which is being kind of looked at intensely by the archival community, which I think mm-hmm. has a lot of prospects. So I'm definitely excited about that. What were you going to say?
Oh, yeah. I mean, at least like at MoMA, our for only standard definition analog derived video, we do QuickTime wrapped uncompressed 10-bit files, keeping standards the same, frame rates the same. And then audio is 48:16 because 24 is kind of difficult. There's also with different companies who make analog to digital converters, there's pros and cons. So you can get 96 kilohertz sample rate, 24 bit depth. Some will support it, some won't. So it's kind of, you have to pick what's more in the pro com than the con column. But I should say, so that's set for standard definition video. For high definition, it's still the Wild West. So we kind of take it case by case and are trying to figure out how to tackle it going forward. But as Eric said, we are also looking at FFV1 because that has a lot of promising features that uncompressed does not address.
Especially in the high definition realm of things, yes. You know, because I think people, you know, it's certainly scalable for a lot of institutions to go uncompressed for the majority of their assets. But, you know, like you said, with high definition pieces, like it's just a massive amount of storage that you have to haul around. So I would like to see that the compression wars like fought on the high definition front and people come with very, you know, logical arguments for them, which I really hope will happen in the next few years.
Yeah. And I should also like qualify, like what I was saying is we are trying to remain as faithful to the original as possible. So that's kind of how we're looking at things in terms of preservation formats.
What Peter said.
Cool.
Yeah, we're mostly able to retain our originals for everything moving forward and stuff from the past. We have like, you know, the set of things that are already digitized. But I think if we were to start from scratch, I'd probably do 10-bit uncompressed in an MOV wrapper. Bam.
Yeah.
Done. I also see a bright future for FFV1 based on what I've heard. So I'm pretty excited about that. The option to use an open source format is it's just like it's actually crucial to being able to decode all this stuff mm-hmm. in the future.
Yeah, I was just gonna say, you know, it's common, you know, the uncompressed 10-bit. It's common recommendation. And you know, I guess we're talking about the difference between, or we haven't talked about it, but
we will.
I think about the difference between preservation and use and uses, you know. So Peter, you said, you know, you're trying to stay as faithful to the original as possible. Mm-hmm. And that's a principle of preservation,
yes.
You know, try to change, affect as little change as possible, make it as look the same as the original as possible, even though you're massively changing it.
Well, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
No. I mean, no. No. That's
get into that debate as well. But yeah.
No. No. It's not a debate. It's just a fact. It's, you know. But
oh, yeah.
But you're trying to stay faithful to it, and that's just what you
you're
know.
Ruining
that,
all the software.
Yeah. I know. That's the goal. But there is, you know, there may be certain cases where that's not the goal, you know, where the goal is, well, you know, we're in a production environment and we need to use this thing like this, and that's more important to us than, you know, a hundred years down the road.
Yes. Yeah.
Kind of thing. You know, which may be the case with the type of thing too. There may be stuff that Human Rights Watch has where it's a little more on that line of, well, okay, this is good enough, or the source that it came from, making it uncompressed would not make it look any better than a lower resolution kind of thing. So, so I think, yeah, there's levels and decisions in there. And I think that's the difficulty when we ask this question, what's the best format? It's, well...
Yeah. You always have the, well...
Yeah, it seems like, not to be so Pollyanna, but I think just to ask the question at all and to be working for an organization that supports your work in trying to find the best preservation format and whatever, you know, that may be through the research that you do is like the most important piece of the puzzle, because I've worked at a couple of places that did, you know, had like large, well-funded digitization efforts and ended up with a preservation format that was like just like a straight up MP3. That was like, you know, if you're gonna do a digitization for like audio cassette tape, for example, it's good to have the highest resolution file made possible to support that. You know, like whatever may be in like in the range of that tape, like you'd want to be able to capture all of it. So some tapes only have one pass left, so you want to make sure that it's a good one and it goes somewhere good. So yeah.
So should I run through a test? I want to run through this test.
Okay.
Okay. So what would you prioritize?
Is this like the Sophie's Choice of the collection?
Okay. So we've got. Okay. Just content doesn't matter. Just consider
purely format.
Yes, purely format, and consider typical condition for the format.
Is this personal? Like, is this our own personal? Like, we're not.
Yeah, okay. not your institutions. These are not representative of the institutions for which these people work.
Disclaimer. Yeah, please. Yeah.
So you've got a 1-inch Type C, U-matic, high 8, D2.
How would you prioritize those?
Yeah, what's your ranking there?
High 8 D2, 1-inch U-matic.
It's hard because, you know, content plays a big factor into it.
Yeah.
Just format, man.
Just format. Content is a separate decision.
Format condition, too. I mean.
Yeah, but consider typical condition for these formats.
Can you give some possible years for the U-matic?
I think I would be
more comfortable answering the question if I knew it was a U-matic from like 1971 or a U-matic from like 1986.
Okay, 1985.
Okay. So yeah, I mean,
I still hold by mine.
Yeah, I would say, yeah, similar. High 8 D2, 1-inch Type C, and then U-matic.
Totally.
That
was really for real. So that was it.
Thanks for providing the year of the imaginary U-matic. Yeah. It's important.
Okay, 1-inch Type B.
Whoa, game changer.
No comment.
Out of curiosity, what are some of the like big issues that, for instance, get argued about on the AMIA listserv or something? Okay, let's not go there. Yeah,
there's only one issue.
Is this the film digital? So what are, I guess, and feel as technical or specific as you need to be, but sort of what's like the hot topics of conversation amongst video preservationists?
What do parents just not understand?
I mean, I would say the big thing that at least my peers and myself discuss is really the high definition and kind of born digital and how to deal with it and kind of what's out there, what's being created, what are the formats. I would say that's the biggest thing that I'm currently kind of thinking about in terms of video, because I feel like, I mean, Eric may disagree, but I feel like analog, in a sense, is kind of figured out for standard definition in terms of preservation. You know, there's quirks of obsolete formats, and obviously you need skilled engineers to get some of this stuff off, but like there is kind of a clear path, in a sense, to migrate this material, while high definition, it's like we're just staying one step ahead of the curve, hopefully.
No, I would definitely agree there. Yeah, it's you know, wrapping your head around a lot of the contemporary video production that's happening, mm-hmm. and try you know the maxim, preserve now for later, you know, like try to get a sense of how, you know, how we could retain these things, and you know, we're going to get there with digital cinema, definitely. I think we're almost there, but you know, it would be encouraging to have some thoughtful discussion about serious things that are happening now, as opposed to kind of having a lot of circular logic about things that have already been figured out.
Yeah.
In public forums.
Yeah.
Which is why I don't usually go on public forums.
But yeah, I mean, to address maybe the topic we're dancing around is this kind of death of film and people mourning the death of film. And it's like, yes, that is one thing, but also it kind of belittles digital in some way. And I think, speaking personally, that just raising them to the same level of discourse, that it's like, it's all, you know, time-based media that we have to address, which just figure it out. And instead of saying, this is very fragile, oh, like, this is impossible, it's just, no, we're engaged, let's do it.
Yeah, I think generally, like, there are very, like I was kind of saying before, there are a lot of, there aren't a lot of great solutions for, like, the new sort of high-definition born digital world in terms of just, like, managing assets, storing assets, keeping track of everything in a format that's playable. And in response to that, there are a lot of solutions, expensive or inexpensive, that are not great to those problems. And in sort of a capitalist world, there's a lot of marketing around certain products, certain ways of doing things. Even certain consultants have much better forms of advertising or are much more vocal. So their opinions are more widely known and their methods are more widely followed at times when maybe their methods don't make as much sense as something that's just either right around the corner or in many cases is already here. And usable. So, some of the forums, I think there's a lot of like really helpful info, but with the motto of don't read the comments, the listservs are just comments. So I think it's good to read those with a sort of positive, a positive attitude and to
that
always.
That can't last.
Yeah. To be as as jovial and accepting as possible.
Yes. To rise above it, if you will.
Yeah.
But I was, and also like, I've just noticed, and maybe I'm just late to this, but a lot of attention is being paid to the open source community, like FFmpeg. And I think more kind of dialogue around that would be extremely useful, because these are people who are very engaged with it, and FFv1 is coming directly out of that. So I think that's gaining a lot of traction, rather than what I think the default used to be, was buying off the shelf like Final Cut 7 and kind of entrusting everything to the Apple Corporation, and seeing that, like, you know, there's an open source community that can support this in some regard.
And that also speaks of a lot of the DIY efforts for a lot of institutions. Like if you're engaged in the open community, then you can do that on a much larger scale. If you do have a lot of in-house reformatting solutions and you're not subservient to, what a vendor has, you know, as a capture card or things like that. So I think, you know, we're all on the same page in that this is like very promising. There was a movement within the Association of Moving Image Archivists conference this year, which was a great, it brought a new kind of feeling to the conferences, as far as I can tell.
I think that's a good thing to bring up when you're talking about the dark arts of video. That they're actually, I think it's got that concept because things are enclosed and you can't see the moving parts and you don't know what's going on in there. But if you look in the right places and you investigate things, you find out what those are. You find out what the capture cards are. You find out the issues that, you know, this format works within this place, but it doesn't work in this place, or this thing can make it and this thing can't. Or, so I think it's, it takes a higher level of investigation than, it's not a dark art. The information is out there, but it's just, you have to find out what the questions are and look into it.
I should say for sure too, in that vein, that there are some people on the listserv and just otherwise in the community who are incredibly knowledgeable and so free and open with teaching and like letting people know, to giving answers to really specific questions just out of the goodness of their heart. I mean, I think I persist because of these people. You know, it's kind of tricky. Some are vendors, some aren't. Some are selling things but aren't trying to sell anything to you. And I think it's just one of the best parts about working in this field is just people are so friendly. And I think also just like finding a community of people who you trust and you can chat with is absolutely key.
And actually, and going back to what you were saying about the dark art and the community kind of exposing it, just takes possibly more research. The one nice thing about kind of born digital video is that before the dark art was kind of aided by, you needed all this equipment to kind of go with it and this cost and space and stuff like that. And you need to know how all the parts fit together. But now with born digital, like essentially you just have to learn how it operates on your computer, but that's only really the only tool you need to get access to it. And then it's just kind of educating yourself about it. So it's easier to kind of, I think, wrap your head around it in that environment, which is, you know, while it's a struggle to kind of figure it out currently, it's easier in that sense.
Absolutely agree there.
Well, this has taken a disconcerting turn towards positivity.
Bring us back down. We're going to lose all of our cultural heritage, right? Or something like that.
Could you talk more about how hard it is in general?
I have an EMP in my bag. And
What's the least failure you've had? Because I know you've had lots of failures and many horrific ones. it's good. No, I think there are, the concern that I always have just comes out of, you know, the time available and the work that needs to be done. You know, it's been a long time. There's a lot of backlog on it. And so there's an urgency there, but there are people like Eric and Peter and Nicole who are out there who are doing the things, who are doing the work and figuring the stuff out, and in the broader community that are, you know, they're out there employing the stuff and doing it. And it's, you know, it's a great thing to talk to you guys and hear about what you're doing and let people know it's not that bad.
No, it's not. It's fun.
I guess it's probably a good
thing. Yeah, okay. I think that's about an hour. So yeah. Obviously, cool. Thanks everyone for talking with us.
Yeah,
thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.